You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. What a trip! Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph forged a friendship on Saturday Night Live and turned it into a hit act at awards shows. With Wine Country, they're doubling down on the funny business of Lady Business by Joy Press. Photographs by Art Streiber, styled by Deborah Afshani. Opening photos, Roadrunners. Poehler's clothing and Rudolph's top by Tori Birch. Rudolph's pants by Kaita, sunglasses by Jacques-Marie Mage, and they are shown sitting in a convertible. And MapQuest. Poehler rounded up some of her Saturday Night Live besties to make Wine Country. Maya Rudolph remembers the first time she met Amy Poehler. It was September 2001, and Poehler had just joined Saturday Night Live, where Rudolph was a cast member. I walked into the writer's room, and I feel like you were sitting on the table and everyone was just gathered around, like, ah, finally, Amy's here, she says. Poehler's face twists in disgust. What an asshole power move, sitting on the table. I hope I was also urinating in all of the corners. The two women are nestled on a sofa in the cozy outbuilding of Poehler's West Hollywood Production Company. The place feels like an eclectic museum. Vintage flea market paintings of naked women, Poehler's Emmy statue, a snapshot of Hillary Clinton, the assortment of sanitary products, and a breast exam tutorial in the bathroom confirm this as a female space. Sitting across from Rudolph and Poehler, I feel like I'm sunning myself in the glow of their mutual affection. They seem instinctively alert to every shift in the other's emotional register, always ready with a gesture or word of encouragement. Whatever the opposite of resting bitch face is, that's what Poehler has. She hovers in a constant state of twinkly amusement, mischievous but never mean. Rudolph is luminous, clad in a khaki green shirt, pants, and coat. She has camouflaged herself to blend into the background. These are two of the most adored comedians in America, chameleons who've rummaged their way through pop culture's closet. They've caricatured Britney and Hillary, Oprah and Donatella, Beyoncé and Dennis Kucinich. The essence of their appeal is a joyful form of contemporary comedy rooted in character study and collaboration. Classic male comedy, especially in stand-up form, is intrinsically sadistic. Its punchlines landing like blows to the ego, which can include lacerating self-humiliation. Poehler and Rudolph might self-deprecate or gently tease, but their style of comedy leans toward accepting and affirming human foibles. They specialize in a kind of deadpannery that stretches the straight man role to the point of subversion. With a simple glance, they're able to say, "Can you believe this shit?" Poehler's most famous creation, relentlessly buoyant Parks and Rec politician Leslie Knope, is a good girl icon and model of civic virtue, whose cultural value seemed to rise after Clinton's loss. At the women's marches, I saw signs sporting some of the characters' femtastic sayings, like uteruses before deuteruses and ovaries before broveries. Leslie also created a fictional holiday, Galentine's Day, dedicated to female friendship, or, as she put it, like Lilith Fair, minus the angst. Female friendship is Poehler and Rudolph's brand. It's the reason they and their pal Tina Fey have become awards show favorites, most recently opening the hostless Oscars. Watching them in action feels like hanging out with the world's sharpest, funniest girl gang. They've knit this goofy, organic camaraderie into the fabric of the new Netflix comedy Wine Country. It's Poehler's first time directing a movie. She also stars alongside Rudolph and a murderer's row of Saturday Night Live lady expats: Rachel Dratch, Anna Gasteyer, Paula Pell, and Emily Spivey. The crew is so tight that they maintain a daily group text. "We all went through something so significant together," Rudolph says. "I always say Saturday Night Live was the comedy army." Poehler's first months at Saturday Night Live were intense. In the aftermath of 9/11, there was an anthrax scare at NBC. Pundits speculated that there was no room for joking in a traumatized America. "No more fun. Good luck, everybody. Let's hope that the building doesn't explode," was the mood, Poehler recalls. It was so wild to be in New York then and have a new job that was so iconic, one that involved finding ways to make the nation laugh. Saturday Night Live had a reputation as a boys' club, but female performers and writers had suddenly achieved a critical mass, and some of the show's most exciting material now revolved around women's experiences. There were fake ads for mom jeans. "Give her something that says, 'I'm not a woman anymore, I'm a mom.'" "Kotex classic pads. I love the belt. It's so complicated," Poehler exhorts. "And Botox. If someone told you all you had to do to get younger-looking skin was to inject a military-grade neurotoxin into your face every 3 weeks, wouldn't you do it?" Rudolph asks soothingly. Poehler says she always gravitated to Rudolph's office, finding her intensely calm demeanor comforting in the middle of the high-wire act that is Saturday Night Live. "So much of live performance is faking that you're not scared," Poehler says. "And Maya never seems scared. She always seems like she's having fun." Rudolph looks pensive. "I do have a very almost dead calm demeanor, almost a little too calm, but that's not the show that's playing on the inside." Their background in improv: Poehler at Chicago's Second City, alongside Faye and Dratch, Rudolph in The Groundlings in L.A., made them both good at creative collaboration. But Rudolph says that Poehler also has an instinct for gathering funny people together and creating an optimum atmosphere for them to play. "Avengers assemble," Poehler shouts. "I like the feeling of that." The friendships forged on Saturday Night Live have not only endured, but flourished creatively. Rudolph starred in Kristen Wiig's Bridesmaids and Spivey's TV series Up All Night, while Poehler and Faye headlined in Paula Pell's Sisters. Their sister-wives' relationship, as Rudolph dubs it, only deepened with time. The demands of work and family meant that these women had to deliberately make the time to hang out. A few years ago, Poehler organized an IRL vacation, inviting Rudolph, Gasteyer, Pell, and Spivey to join her in a Napa Valley Airbnb for Dratch's 50th birthday. During the short flight there, Poehler went to the bathroom, and while pulling up her pants, became convinced she dropped her cell phone in the toilet. It was a devastating blow, since her phone held the obsessively detailed plans she'd made for the long weekend. Poehler found her friends' reactions to her misfortune perfectly encapsulated their personalities. Rudolph instantly morphed into a maternal figure. "Let me get some gloves. I'm going to look for that phone." Spivey responded, despairingly, according to Poehler, "This is my worst nightmare. If I lost my phone, I would die." Pell offered to go with her to the Apple store as soon as they landed to buy a new one. Gasteyer shrugged off the panic. "Your phone's in your bag. Don't worry about it." Next, photos, smiles to go. The film is loosely based on real-life trips the women took with friends. And it's a gas. In the photos, the women are gassing up the classic Mustang for the road trip. Poehler's phone was in her bag. A later jaunt to Palm Springs for Gasteyer's 50th birthday, which they nicknamed Moo-Moo Nitpick because everyone wore moo-moos and bitched, was similarly jolly. Pell brought $800 worth of high-end vibrators as party favors. She even packed batteries for everybody, because she is thoughtful that way. Poehler became convinced these trips were fodder for a film, not only because these are the greatest, funniest performers, she says, but there's just not enough films that take full advantage of what it's like to be our age and to be around women that have known you for a really long time, but aren't competing for the same job or the same guy. Spivey and fellow Saturday Night Live vet Liz Kakowski wrote the screenplay for Wine Country. Poehler's production company, Paper Kite, sold it to Netflix. They shot it over a 7-week period in Los Angeles and Napa. Gasteyer says her husband described the project to their kids as the female version of The Hangover, set in Wine Country. She prefers to think of it not as a lost weekend so much as a found weekend. In the fictional romp, Abby Poehler has organized a Napa weekend to celebrate the 50th birthday of Rebecca Dratch. A therapist, Rebecca seems uncomfortable with the attention. "I just want to slide into 50," she protests, and spends a lot of time trying to diffuse conflict among her old friends. There's curmudgeonly Jenny, Spivey, who says things like, "How can I be generous when I hate most other people?" Val, Pell, is fresh out of knee replacement surgery and ready to flirt with local waitresses. Entrepreneur Catherine Gasteyer can't put aside her work, while Naomi Rudolph is consumed by secret worries. Abby has planned the trip down to the millisecond, but everything goes off the rails. The women get soused, rock out to retro tunes, face off against a room full of millennials, and flex their physical comedy skills. They also discuss the vagaries of aging, the horror of a back that goes out at just the wrong moment, or pubic hair that resembles Colonel Sanders' goatee. Tina Fey makes sporadic appearances as the owner of the rented house. She was too busy with other projects to shoot the main ensemble scenes. In an industry where female characters have only 35% of the speaking roles in top movies, Wine Country does something remarkable. The few men in it, one is played by Jason Schwartzman, are marginal, existing only to serve the ladies. And although many of the female characters have partners and kids back home, they barely get a mention. When women are together, they're really excited to be in their witchy circle, Poehler says. The movie aces the Bechdel test. In Wine Country, no two straight men even talk to each other. Every film has a certain amount of real estate. It was nice not to give that precious real estate to a story we didn't want to tell, Poehler says with a shrug, making light of this triumph. Although Wine Country brings together characters who've been friends since they were teenagers, it doesn't squeeze laughs from a reversion to adolescent behavior or grotesquerie. The movie's not about ladies who can't act their age, Poehler declares. A man's midlife crisis is, gets a fancy car, F's somebody too young for him, has a crazy weekend, and realizes what he's got. I don't even know what the female version of that is. She looks at Rudolph, who offers self-mutilation, probably some Kegels, Botox parties, maybe a tattoo for the first time, Poehler says. The women I know in their 40s and 50s are incredibly interesting, funny, accomplished, doing a million things, and there's a lot of rich stories to tell there that don't involve loss or fear of being left. Although the characters in Wine Country are somewhat tethered to the real-life quirks of their performers, the movie is not a simple reflection of their off-screen friend network. It's a vehicle designed to showcase each other's comedic strengths. Dratch's genius for funny noises and looks, Rudolph's musical chops, Pell's knack for broad physical comedy. We already have this common language where we can set each other up and, what's that word in volleyball? Rudolph asks. Alley-oop, Poehler says without missing a beat. Rudolph tilts her head and shoots her friend a dubious look. Alley-oop the volleyball? She asks hesitantly. Poehler confirms, yeah, you oop it up. Rudolph runs with it. You oop it up. And that was also part of the delicious goal of this. Why not work with these people that you love working with, that you do not have to question? Poehler says she fantasizes about establishing a commune with these women as they grow older, pointing out, we will technically live longer than most of the men in our lives, knock on wood. These ladies are going to change my diapers, affirms Rudolph. She seems open to the commune idea until she remembers that the last time Poehler rented a house for their group vacation, there were bugs in the bed. Oh my God, that's right, Amy wails, putting her hands over her eyes. Believe me, I will take that to my grave. Aside from the slip-up with the critter-infested house rental, turned out it was termites, Poehler is a born organizer. Directing your best friends in a movie sounds tricky, but her pals say she has a rare ability to exert authority in a way that sparks creativity instead of crushing it. She had her work cut out for her with having to wrangle us because we're always doing bits and chatter and talking, says Spivey. She's really like a good mama bear. Poehler is trying to figure out how to be the best boss possible now that she is working behind the scenes on even more projects. She has produced shows like Broad City and I Feel Bad, and for Russian Doll, which she co-created with Natasha Lyonne and Leslie Headland, Poehler hired all female writers and directors. In the works are the Fox animated series Duncanville and Moxie, a Netflix movie about a teen girl inspired by her mother's riot girl past, which Poehler plans to direct herself. Meanwhile, Rudolph has been carving out her own opportunities. She and former Saturday Night Live castmate Fred Armiston handpicked writers to create an Amazon series for them. The result is the idiosyncratic anti-rom-com forever. Like The Good Place, on which Rudolph features as the closest thing to God, Forever is tangled up in existential questions. When we were making Forever, I loved talking about death, she admits. As someone who lost her mother, singer Minnie Riperton, at a very young age, Rudolph says, I loved talking about the afterlife. I want to know. I'm so curious. Is this it? At the end of last year, Rudolph joined forces with her pal Lyonne. They were briefly roommates in their 20s to form a production company, Animal Pictures. But Rudolph says she isn't sure she wants to try directing. I always thought that I would, but the closer I get to that idea, I'm like, I'm not there yet. Poehler beams at her encouragingly and says, I feel like you can do anything you want. Rudolph smiles. Really? Poehler nods. You'd be amazing at anything you do. A few days after our interview, I run into Rudolph and Poehler at Vanity Fair's post-Oscars bash. It's my first time at the party, and I feel like I'm in the center of a celebrity roulette wheel. Turn in any direction, and there's a superstar holding court or posing for beautifully lit photos. Poehler is twirling on the dance floor in a tailored Alberta Ferretti tux next to Rudolph in a voluminous fuchsia Stella McCartney gown. Tina Fey and Rashida Jones shimmy betwixt and between, grinning wildly at each other as if they're just a bunch of girlfriends letting loose on an ordinary weekend. As Rudolph and Poehler zigzag across the floor, they come to a halt to chat with Barbara Streisand and Anita Hill, then make their way into the main room, where Frances McDormand swoops in on them. Suddenly, Chloe Sevigny and Natasha Lyonne are there too, as if conjured from thin air, to join the circle. For a few minutes they huddle together, a heaving mass of satin and sequins. I'm standing off to the side, observing all this, when Rudolph sees me and envelops me in a hug. Gesturing at the scene behind, a Hollywood woman power fantasy come to life, she says, "Can you believe this?" In Cold Blood. Elizabeth Holmes built Theranos, her $9 billion blood-testing startup, on a host of extraordinary lies. But the company's final days were littered with sad truths, blinding legal bills, demoralized employees, deceit, and a wolf who was really a dog that pooped all over the office. By Nick Bilton. Elizabeth Holmes appeared to know exactly what she needed to do. It was September 2017, and the situation was dire. Theranos, the blood testing company that she had dreamed up more than a decade ago, during her freshman year at Stanford, was imploding before her very eyes. John Carreyrou, an investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal, had spent nearly 2 years detailing the startup's various misdeeds, questioning the veracity of its lab results, and the legitimacy of its core product, the Edison, a small consumer blood testing device that supposedly used just a drop of blood to perform hundreds of medical tests. Carreyrou had even revealed that Theranos relied on third-party devices to administer its own tests. Theranos, which had raised nearly $1 billion in funding for a valuation estimated at around $9 billion, now appeared less a medical sciences company than a house of cards. Owing largely to Carreyrou's reporting, the fallout had been colossal, unprecedented. Theranos was under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Department of Justice, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It had been sued by investors. Walgreens, its largest partner, terminated the relationship and shut down 40 testing sites. Forbes, which had once estimated Holmes' wealth at $4.5 billion, wrote it down to zero. The young founder, who had been compared to Steve Jobs, was now being dubbed a millennial Madoff by the New York Post. In a photo, stained, charged with conspiracy and wire fraud, Elizabeth Holmes leaves federal court in San Jose in January. According to two former executives at the company, Theranos had as many as 9 different law firms on retainer, including the formidable Boies Schiller Flexner, to handle the mess. What appeared to be the end of a long, labored, highly visible, and heinous corporate death march. But Holmes had other ideas. Despite the chaos, she believed that Theranos could still be saved, and she had an unconventional plan for redemption. That September, according to the two former executives, Holmes asked her security detail and one of her drivers to escort her to the airport in her designated black Cadillac Escalade. She flew first class across the country and was subsequently chauffeured to a dog breeder who supplied her with a 9-week-old Siberian husky. The puppy had long white paws and a gray and black body. Holmes had already picked out a name, Balto. For Holmes, the dog represented the journey that lay ahead for Theranos. As she explained to colleagues at the company's headquarters in Palo Alto, he was named after the world-famous sled dog who, in 1925, led a team of huskies on a dangerous 600-mile trek from Nenana, Alaska, to remote Nome, bearing an antitoxin that was used to fight a diphtheria outbreak. There is even a statue of Balto in New York's Central Park, Holmes told one former employee. The metaphorical connection was obvious. In Holmes' telling, Balto's perseverance mirrored her own. His voyage with the life-changing drug was not so different from her own ambitious journey. In Silicon Valley, founders and CEOs often embrace a signature idiosyncrasy as a personal branding device. Steve Jobs wore the same black turtleneck every day and tended to park in handicapped spots. Mark Zuckerberg went through a phase during which he would eat only the meat of animals he had personally killed. Jack Dorsey drinks a strange lemon water concoction every morning and goes on 10-day silent retreats while wearing designer clothing and an Apple Watch. Holmes had seemingly cherry-picked from her elders. She wore a black turtleneck, drank strange green juices, traveled with armed guards, and spoke in a near baritone. In an industry full of oddballs, Holmes, a blonde WASP who grew up around Houston and Washington, D.C., appeared hell-bent on cultivating a reputation as an iconoclastic weirdo. Having Balto seemed to help fortify the image. Immediately after returning to California, Holmes decided that Balto would hardly leave her side on the quest to save Theranos. Each day, she would wake up with Balto at the nearly empty Los Altos mansion that she was renting about 6 miles from her company's headquarters. Theranos covered the house's rent. Soon after, they would be picked up by one of Holmes's two drivers, or sometimes by her two security personnel, or one of her two assistants, and set off for work. And for the rest of the day, Balto would stroll through the labs with his owner. Holmes brushed it off when the scientist protested that the dog hair could contaminate samples. But there was another problem with Balto. He wasn't potty trained. Accustomed to the undomesticated life, the animal frequently urinated and defecated at will throughout Theranos headquarters. While Holmes held board meetings, Balto could be found in the corner of the room relieving himself, while a frenzied assistant was left to clean up the mess. Around the same time, Holmes says, she discovered that Balto, like most huskies, had a tiny trace of wolf origin. Henceforth, she decided that Balto wasn't really a dog, but rather a wolf. In meetings, at cafes, whenever anyone stopped to pet the pup and ask his breed, Holmes soberly replied, "He's a wolf." Silicon Valley can often feel like a lawless place, and for good reason. Many of the people who run the largest technology companies on Earth don't often suffer the consequences of their actions. Despite their unequivocal role in upending our democracy, Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg still run Facebook. Dorsey is still the CEO of Twitter, even though he has not been forthright about the number of bots on the service and has done almost nothing to stop the spread of hate speech on his platform. Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, has been charged with securities fraud, and yet he's still running the company. Musk agreed with the SEC that he would step down as chairman and pay a $20 million fine. Holmes is that rare exception in which consequences occur, and the public, perhaps fed up with the behavior of other tech giants, and that of many Wall Street bankers before them, has been captivated by her downfall. 3 years after Carreyrou began his investigation, Holmes has again become a figure of extraordinary pop culture fascination, a distinct rarity for a business person. Her story is the subject of the HBO documentary The Inventor and ABC News' podcast series The Dropout. Bad Blood, Carreyrou's book, has sold 500,000 copies and is being developed for Hollywood by Adam McKay. Jennifer Lawrence is set to play Holmes. Disclosure, I was a consulting producer on the HBO project, which was partly based on an article I wrote for Vanity Fair. About Theranos, nearly 3 years ago, the fascination with Holmes often fixates on her extraordinary rise. Her ability to convince Stanford scientists to believe her idea despite her lack of formal training. Her aptitude for getting wise men, Henry Kissinger, James Mattis, George Shultz, to sit on her board. And her skill for obtaining early funding from eminences such as Rupert Murdoch and the Walton family. But the final days of Theranos were equally chilling. After all, Holmes wasn't just an inexperienced scientist. She was also a wild-spending fiduciary. Holmes had always enjoyed a certain lifestyle. From the early days of the company, she had insisted on flying in a private jet. As the company's legal problems mounted, its cost skyrocketed. But Holmes had a hard time weaning herself off a number of luxuries. She still had her own personal security detail, drivers, assistants, and a personal publicist who was on retainer for $25,000 a month, according to one of the former executives. Theranos had an indemnity agreement with Holmes, and Sunny Balwani, the company's COO, with whom she had been romantically involved. They are no longer dating. Theranos paid all their legal bills, which totaled millions of dollars a month, according to both executives. By late 2017, however, Holmes had begun to slightly rein in the spending. She agreed to give up her private jet travel, not a good look, and downgraded to first class on commercial airlines. But given that she was flying all over the world, trying to obtain more funding for Theranos, she was spending tens of thousands of dollars a month on travel. Theranos was also still paying for her mansion in Los Altos and for her team of personal assistants and drivers who would become regular dog walkers for Balto. But there were few places she had wasted so much money as in the design and monthly cost of the company's main headquarters, which employees referred to simply as 1701 for its street address along Page Mill Road in Palo Alto. The property, according to two former executives, cost $1 million a month to rent. Holmes had also spent $100,000 on a single conference table. Elsewhere in 1701, she had asked for another circular conference room that the former employees said looked like the war room from Dr. Strangelove, replete with curved glass windows and screens that would come out of the ceiling so that everyone in the room could see a presentation without having to turn their heads. But by the end of 2017, it had become clear that it was financially untenable to stay in 1701, largely owing to Theranos's legal expenditures. The remaining employees were told they would be moving to the Theranos laboratory facility across the bay in Newark, California. Employees who were still at Theranos at the time described Newark as crummy and a shithole. The building was formerly home to a solar panel maker, and it had a huge floor space. Employees were set up on the second floor, where people would sit four to a table in the open floor plan. Holmes took the corner office with Balto. The move may have been a last-gasp attempt to save the company, but morale at Theranos was already at an all-time low. The SEC and other government agencies had started to subpoena current and former workers. Remaining employees started to resign or were let go, almost on a daily basis, it seemed. As two former employees told me, you could go to Antonia's Nut House, the famous Palo Alto bar, any night of the week, and there would reliably be a goodbye gathering for at least one Theranos employee. Yet through all of this, former employees of the company have told me Holmes had a bizarre way of acting like nothing was wrong. Even more peculiar, she appeared happy. The company is falling apart. There are countless indictments piling up. Employees are leaving in droves. And Elizabeth is just weirdly chipper, a former senior executive said. One former board member also noted that Holmes would come to board meetings chirpy and acting as if everything were great. She would walk up to people in the office who could have just testified in front of the SEC or been questioned by lawyers at the FDA, and she would give them a hug and ask how they were doing. She was so confident that the company would be fine, executives who worked with her said, that she enrolled Balto in a search and rescue program. Holmes spent weekends training him to find people in an emergency. Unfortunately, huskies are not bred for rescue. They are long-distance runners, and Balto failed out. For years, Holmes had relished in the ritual of giving speeches to the staff. When Balwani worked at Theranos, the speeches ended with chants. Some were positive, and some were more famously negative, such as when employees in lab coats would chant F.U. to a competitor or journalist. But such rhetoric was usually followed by excited cheers and roars. One day in late December 2017, Holmes showed up at the Newark building and held an all-hands meeting. Brimming with enthusiasm, she told her employees that Fortress Investment Group, one of the world's largest private investment companies, had agreed to offer a $100 million loan that would allow Theranos to survive. But Holmes didn't appear to receive the response that she craved. One executive who was there told me the room was silent. After an uncomfortable beat, Holmes said, "Does anyone have any questions?" Again, nothing, just a bristling silence. By this point, the morale had been completely drained out of the company, the employee explained. Months later, Holmes was charged with 11 criminal felony counts, including wire fraud and conspiracy. Theranos was essentially gutted by the spring of 2018. It shuttered in September 2018, 1 year after Holmes had adopted Balto. Fortress got ownership of all of Theranos' patents. The $900 million she had raised was up in smoke. Since Theranos' collapse, observers have wondered how Holmes kept the company going for so long. Recently, I posed a similar question to a former Theranos board member. How did the board of directors, composed of such accomplished people, not stop her? This person said that board members ask tough questions but were fed contrived answers. Notably, the board was stacked with dignitaries, not scientists. After the Journal broke the news that the company was being investigated, the board suggested that Holmes take the Theranos blood test and compare the results with those of two other competing labs and one university lab, this person said. If all the results were the same, Theranos could prove to regulators and the media, so went the logic, that its blood testing products worked perfectly. If the test showed that Theranos' results were off, the board suggested, Holmes could direct the company's considerable raised capital toward fixing the problem. Holmes agreed to the trial, but then withheld the results, the former board member told me. When the board asked about the findings, Holmes seemed to offer a series of obfuscations. Sometimes she would say she was waiting on results. At other times, she said there had been problems with the test. Eventually, this got heated. At one meeting, according to the former board member, a Theranos employee presented financials that indicated that a Theranos lab in Arizona had not generated the revenues that Holmes had communicated to her directors. This was one of the few times where board members criticized their CEO, this person said. One board member was visibly irate. It appeared that Holmes had been deceptive. Soon after, Holmes shook up the board. Holmes will almost certainly face legal consequences, but it may take a while. Justice Department officials, according to a filing from January 2019, are combing through between 16 million and 17 million pages of documents. And there could be more charges filed against Holmes and Balwani, and even other people close to them. Assistant U.S. Attorney John C. Bostic said in court recently that the story is bigger than what's captured in the original indictment, and that the indictment doesn't capture all the criminal conduct that the investigation has uncovered so far. Holmes faces up to 20 years in prison. Holmes and Balwani have stated that the charges are baseless. Theranos represented a business failure, according to one line of exculpatory logic. But it was not created to rip off investors or mislead consumers. It was an actual fraud. Also, according to another argument, neither of them actually made any money from Theranos. But their lifestyles were partly funded by the company. Holmes's travel, security details, and publicist were all paid for by Theranos. Meals, clothing, and other social activities were often expensed. As one of the former employees said to me, someone had to be paying for all those Birkin bags. This employee said that Holmes' expenses were somewhat of a joke at the company. The company paid for everything, they said. She would submit her miles if she drove the 6 miles to her house in Los Altos. The employee said that the only time Holmes evidenced defeat during Theranos' collapse was when the company cut her off financially after the criminal charges were filed. She lost her cool. She had a fit, they said. She had to give up the house in Los Altos. When I ask the former executive close to Holmes if she has come to regret what happened, the response surprised me. Elizabeth sees herself as the victim, this person said. She blames John Carreyrou, she blames David Boyce, and she blames Heather King. Boyce, the star lawyer, had sat on Theranos' board and represented the company during the Carreyrou crisis. King, Theranos' general counsel for 15 months, overlapped with this period. King now works at Boyce's firm. Holmes, according to the former employees, blames the lawyers for giving her bad advice and for their inability to contain the bad press stemming from Carreyrou's superb reporting. When I asked Carreyrou what he thought about this theory, he told me, I just reported the facts. If there had been nothing to my reporting, federal prosecutors wouldn't have brought criminal fraud charges, and those charges wouldn't be supported by 17 billion pages of evidence. Boyce and King declined to comment, citing bar obligations. Neither Holmes nor her counsel responded to request for comment. In his book, Carreyrou muses about an oft-raised question regarding Holmes. Is she just a young person who got in over her head? Or, more dramatically, is something more serious afoot? Is she a sociopath? I'll leave it to the psychologist to decide whether Holmes fits the clinical profile, he writes, but there's no question that her moral compass was badly askew. Former employees raise this question with frequency. One pointed to a formative experience. Holmes' father, Christian, was an executive at Enron, and the family's finances were affected by its collapse. Did Holmes vow to revive the family's fortunes at all cost? Was she a hustler or a con artist, or merely a staggering Mr. Ripley? One of Elizabeth's superpowers is she never looks back, this person said. Holmes is currently living in San Francisco in a luxury apartment. She's engaged to a younger hospitality heir who also works in tech. She wears his MIT signet ring on a necklace, and the couple regularly post stories on Instagram professing their love for each other. She reliably looks chirpy and chipper. She's also abandoned the black turtleneck look and now dresses in athleisure, the regrettable attire of our age. Notably, she is far from a hermit. She tells former colleagues, according to the two executives, that she is greeted by well-wishers on the street who are rooting for her resurrection. Meanwhile, former Theranos employees I have spoken to have relayed horror stories about their inability to find work after leaving the company. Holmes, for her part, still doesn't seem to think the work of Theranos is finished. She still wants people to know that Theranos, like Balto, was going to save the world. But to make this happen, she needs to share her side of the events. She has recently held more meetings with filmmakers to try to collaborate on a documentary about her real story, and Holmes desperately wants to write a book. In Holmes' eyes, according to former employees, this is only the beginning of yet another redemption story, possibly one that is too good to be true. Thank you. Duel of the Mega Dealers by Michael Schneerson. The current standoff between Larry Gagosian and David Zwirner, the feuding titans of contemporary art. Their high-stakes skirmish to represent the late Austrian artist Franz Fest. Photo illustration by Michelle Thompson. Big Deals, David Zwirner, Larry Gagosian, and Sculptures by Franz Fest, who died in 2012. This article is adapted from Boom, Mad Money, Mega Dealers, and The Rise of Contemporary Art by Michael Schneerson, to be published on May 21, 2019 by Public Affairs. Copyright 2019 by Michael Schneerson. Every June, they fly in like an air force of contemporary art. The world's top dealers and collectors landing in Basel, Switzerland, for the year's most significant fair. Of that glittering throng, four figures stand apart. The mega dealers occupy booths no different from the rest. They just sell a lot more art. Not $1 million here at Art Basel, but tens of millions. Not tens of millions over the course of a year, but hundreds of millions. Or in the case of Larry Gagosian, $1 billion. If, that is, you believe those numbers, the mega dealers may boast of a particular sale, but all are private, and they stay mum on profits in what is notoriously the world's largest unregulated market of legal goods. At 48, Swiss-born Ewan Wirth of Hauser & Wirth is the youngest of the four. Oldest at 80 is Arnie Glimcher, who opened New York City's Pace Gallery in 1963. Glimcher has notched many of the top sales of the last half-century and remains a force, but he is openly weary of the global bazaar that contemporary art has become. "This market has nothing to do with art," he says. "It's all about how fast one can make money." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.